Judiciary Committee come to order, please. It's 1:34 in the afternoon of Friday, March 18th, 2011. We have a quorum to conduct business here. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Pascan, Senator Coghill, and myself, Senator French. We have three matters before the committee today. SB 86, the governor's bill dealing with, in general, elder fraud and abuse. We have Senator Dyson's SB 30, which we will put a CS in front of the committee on. I think that settles most of the concerns I had. And finally, SCR 2, Senator Davis's bill on establishing a Senate President pro tempore. So let's start with the meatiest bill and the biggest bill in front of us, SB 86. This is intended today mainly to be a work session between the committee and the affected departments to try to reach at least a place where we can begin to prepare a CS to move the bill on its way. I think it's, in general, a good bill. I think the committee likes the idea and the reforms here. We're just, you know, down into the nitty-gritty details of trying to get language that serves everyone's purposes. Stop for just 2 seconds and welcome Senator Wilikowski. And we are just about to start work on SB 86. So we have the commissioner here. Welcome, the Commissioner Schreuer, to the committee. Nice to see you, Commissioner, and your able assistants, both from your department and the Department of Law. Let's go ahead and perhaps have the representative from the Department of Law come forward. We also, I think, have online Scott Sterling, who made the rounds last week or 2 weeks ago when this bill was first presented to touch base, I know, with my office regarding his views of the matter. He's the sort of abuse prosecutor or abuse attorney for the Office of Public Advocacy. And I know he sent memo to me and other members of the committee containing some of the ideas he had for the bill. So that's...
thank you, Senator French. We're here. Scott Sterling speaking. And the acting deputy director of OPA, Ms. Trimmer, is also here to answer questions if need be.
Okay, very good. And thank you. And as we're proceeding, just feel free to jump in as necessary. I'll turn to you when I think of it. But if I don't and you have something to say, just ring out. It's an informal work session, although we are, of course, on the record. Just to let other members of the committee know, we have David Shade from the Department of Public Safety and Janice Stewart from the Department of Public Safety to answer questions, and Tracy Page, the Supervisor for Adult Protective Services, also here to answer questions. So we got unbelievable amounts of horsepower. Maybe we can get some work done. Let's see. Let's start by taking up some notice provisions that came to my attention and see what we can do with them. On page, I believe it's section 25. Actually, it's actually in the underlying statute. And so I need section title 13. As we're dealing with, and I'm talking about the provisions of the bill that deal with ex parte orders, which are on page 4, new section 1326.209. And that sets up ex parte orders, much as we have ex parte domestic violence orders. But as I was reading through the statutes, I noticed that there are notice provisions dealing with the... orders we have on the books right now, and it struck me that there was a conflict. And let me just bring that to the attention of the Department of Law. And that is back here in 185. Here it is. The ex parte orders, of course, are typically issued without notice to the other side. One side goes to a judge, asks in an emergency setting to get an order. The judge listens to the petition and either grants it or doesn't grant it. But normally there's only one person in the courtroom, which is, of course, highly unusual. Courtrooms like to have two people, one from each side of the controversy there when things are decided. As it stands right now, if you go to get a protective order, go to get a conservator appointed, the law says on a petition for appointment of a conservator or other protective order, the person to be protected, the person's spouse, if none, et cetera, must be served personally by certified mail or by any other method of notice of the hearing. When it says, and that's 1326.185, I think when it says, or other protective order, that could include an ex parte protective order, and so it strikes me that we need now to carve that out to make clear that we don't have two sets of notice requirements under a traditional order or normal order and an ex parte order. So that's one concern. The other concern I had with respect to notice is also on page 4, and it's on line 22, and I noticed that Scott Sterling had the same concern. The concern is we're now allowing, because you're protecting a vulnerable adult, it's probably not the vulnerable adult who goes into court. A traditional DV order, you've got a man and a woman, and, you know, one of the two of them feels abused, one of the two of them goes to court and asks for a protective order. In this case, there's almost always going to be three people involved. There's going to be the vulnerable adult, and there's going to be people who are either on either side of either protecting or not protecting that vulnerable adult. The bill, as it comes to us, says that the petitioner on lines 21 and 22, the petitioner shall certify to the court in writing any effort the petitioner made to provide notice to the respondent, to the other person on the other side of the dispute. And Mr. Sterling, I think, and I both feel like there should be some notice to the vulnerable adult involved as well, because you're never going to know, at least as we write the bill, what level of vulnerability, what level of awareness, what level of ability that individual is going to have. So maybe why don't we stop after having made those two points, turn to either Mr. Sterling or to the Department of Law and see what their views are.
I'll let Mr. Sterling speak to this.
Okay. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree that we want to have consistency between the existing part that you pointed out in 1326.185, and I appreciate the chair bringing that to my attention because I didn't realize we had overlooked that. And I think we can carve out an exception for the protective orders that are authorized by the new section, and I will be happy to work on some language to address that situation. Secondly, on page 4, line 22, the concern, which I've addressed in a memo to the chair, and in the work that the administration team has been doing on the companion bill, we think we've come up with language that would address that to ensure that the vulnerable adult, whether that person is the actual respondent or not, or the actual petitioner or not, will receive notice of the proceedings unless it is certified to the court that providing that notice would cause or worsen the immediate harm that the person is facing. The idea is twofold. One would be to prevent an unscrupulous third party from using this remedy for unscrupulous purposes, and the other would be to ensure that the vulnerable adult, whatever their capacity may be, will know that relief is being sought on their behalf. Most likely, based on experience, in most cases, the vulnerable adult probably will be the petitioner, and we won't have to address that issue. But in that instance, if I may, what we're trying to address here is a case where an incapacitated or person suffering from diminished capacity is being victimized, and a third party recognizes that and takes action to stop that harm. We wanted to be able to have the third party come in and say, I'm not the victim, I'm speaking on the victim's behalf, and I'm seeking relief on their behalf, but simultaneously make sure, unless it would cause immediate harm, that regardless of capacity, that the person would receive notice. So we're trying to navigate a particular channel there that may occur without shutting that person off from being able to obtain this relief if it's needed.
And that makes sense to me, at least. And maybe just for the purposes of this section, you can walk us through how, and let's just use a hypothetical in which we have a vulnerable parent, a evil brother, and a good-hearted sister. right? And so, and just so we just sort of have three human beings assigned to this instead of, you know, third party and, mm-hmm. and so forth.
Well, first question that would be asked is, does a vulnerable adult have capacity? If they do, and they're able to act on their own, then this relief would be available to them as the petitioner.
The vulnerable adult could walk into court and say, you know, keep the evil son away from me, and just ask for relief on his or her own behalf.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Then let's hypothesize where the vulnerable adult, same situation, but they lack capacity and are being exploited. The good-hearted sister would come in as a third-party representative of the victim, and under penalty of perjury, certify to the court, I'm here to represent a person who cannot speak for themselves. I have probable cause to believe they are in immediate danger of financial exploitation, either ongoing or imminent. And on that basis, I would like to have relief. I would also like to exempt notice of this being sent to the perpetrator, because the perpetrator may intercept it, to the vulnerable adult, because the perpetrator may intercept it.
Right.
It's possible that they could be doing that. But in most situations, the court would have to make inquiry, and then unless there's a specific finding that the notice should not be sent, the court would ensure that the vulnerable adult, despite their lack of capacity, would still be notified. And the underlying theory would be, it is better to freeze and stabilize the situation so that Adult Protective Services, elder fraud, whatever other agency may be involved, can make inquiries without the assets or property of the adult continuing to be dissipated while those inquiries are undertaken.
Okay. I think the general outline of the approach is sound. And let me just ask, did you develop specific language for the House side working on this bill?
Yes, we did.
Okay, great. We'll take a look.
And the companion bill is now in the form of a CS in the other body, and we should be able to share all that readily with the Senate committee.
Excellent. And let me just ask, as while we're in the ex parte order arena, have you seen and reviewed the letter to me and other members of the Judiciary Committee from Mark Reagan, the legal director at the Disability Law Center?
I have not.
Okay. I will summarize it for you, and then we can just hold that off until you've had a chance to look. But he sent me a letter on the 16th of this month, and the specific recommendation he makes is with respect to Section 209, the one we're looking at, that says that there should be an opportunity for the person to be protected, or I guess I would say the respondent as well, to seek modification or termination of any ex parte protective order on 3 days' notice, as is now possible with ex parte domestic violence restraining orders, and to add a provision ensuring that counsel for the person to be protected is appointed immediately in cases involving either temporary conservatorships or ex parte protective orders. And he supplied some draft language to that effect.
I would be most interested to see that, and I'm sure the rest of the administration team would too. My initial impression would be, certainly under existing law, the respondent is entitled to appointment of counsel under Rule 12 of the administrative rules and under our probate rules. And by extension, this ex parte provision as part of Title 13 would fit more closely with the situation we have where counsel is appointed for respondents in guardian and conservatorship proceedings. It would be different from the domestic violence situation, however, where counsel is not appointed for the respondent in the domestic violence arena. So that would be a divergence from the practice under Title 18, Chapter 66. But I would I would, yes, I would like to see that letter in language if I could, because on the surface, I see no reason why a person ought not to be able to come in and say, okay, I understand what's happening, and I now need it modified or dismissed, speaking for my own interests.
Sure. I mean, going back to our parent and, you know, a good sister and evil brother, you can just see where this is a fast-breaking situation. There may be substantial assets of the vulnerable parent at risk. And, you know, I hate to say it, but probably the quicker that everybody gets into court in front of a judge, the better.
Well, we tend to think so because our experience has been, the impetus for this comes in part from our experience where we're often trying to put legal protections around vulnerable persons where the assets are long gone.
Right.
And if we'd only been able to act quicker, or if the person, most importantly, if they had been able to act on their own without a lawyer, and get expedited relief, we might have been able to prevent the loss, or at least stop it, and stabilize the situation until more information and a clearer picture can be developed.
Very good. I don't see any other further questions about this section. I'll just point out to the committee that we got a excellent set of definitions of undue influence from other states. I know that had been something that was on my mind and other committee members' minds. It's in the packet that you received that begins with the memo from Mr. Sterling. It's a dozen states or more's takes on undue influence. I'm sure it'll be something we focus on more, but there's just plenty of items there to look at and review as the bill is before us. I know it's certainly one of the biggest changes we're making here, and it's something that's on a lot of folks' mind is how exactly do we nail down that definition. Anyone have any further comments on that? Okay. Senator Pascan.
Maybe not a question substantively, but how many people do you estimate would be able to take advantage of this type of ex parte protective order process?
Anyone want to answer? How many is, Mr. Sterling, do you know how many protective orders for vulnerable adults are being issued today?
Senator Passman, through the chair. Senator Passman, that's an excellent question. We don't really have immediate protective order relief mechanisms in the law at this time. The most that can be done at this time is to file an emergency petition or expedited petition for a conservatorship. And I don't know on the Adult Protective Services side, Ms. Henriksen and Ms. Gibbons isn't there, but Ms. Page would know on the Adult Protective Services side what that might be. In terms of our caseload, I would say probably half of the cases that come into our office are those where the assets have either already been dissipated or are in the process of being dissipated, and the remedies available to me under existing law are either or both to seek a temporary conservatorship on an expedited basis or file a civil action and apply for a TRO.
Senator Pascan.
In other words, what I'm thinking about is this going to be 500 cases statewide to where, you know, that's going to have an impact on the court systems to the where we need to think about that as well. Not saying it's a barrier to doing it, but just, you know, what is the consequence of having this law enacted?
Through the chair, Senator Pascan. It may well rise to that level over time. The nearest thing I can cite, if it's helpful, is the experience that society underwent with the enactment of the Domestic Violence Protection Order law, where in a gradual but very firm way, the statistics did increase quite a bit over time, to where the magistrates and masters and judges were entertaining those petitions on a regular and routine basis. I don't know if we will reach that level. For the sake of our common good, I would hope we wouldn't, but it may. That's the best answer I can think of to give. It may rise to a few hundred a year over time.
And I'll just say we do have Ms. Gibbons on the line. If there's anything you want to add, please feel free.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think that
just identify yourself, please, for the record. It's tough for our clerks.
For the record, I'm Joanne Gibbons, and I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Senior and Disability Services.
Thank you.
And I can tell you at this point about how many calls we get per year regarding financial exploitation, which is what this is about. For FY10, we received over 500 calls, about 541 calls regarding financial exploitation. Now, how many of those resulted in actual verified cases, that data I don't have, but we could certainly get that to you. But in terms of the number of calls we get regarding this issue, and those would be duplicated calls, I'm sure more of them, but that might give you, some kind of a reference point.
Thank you. And Senator Passman.
What's the population base? Is that a statewide call-in number, or is that, what's the population base?
Yes, that would be that's a statewide number, and that's the number for all vulnerable adults.
Further questions on the scope of the problem? Doug. Mr. Wolliver, do you have something to add? You stood up. I'll call on you. Thank you.
You might have something to say. Mm-hmm.
Please put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Doug Wolliver, administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. I can tell you what our court numbers show.
Please.
for filings. We show when it's a combination of conservatorship and guardianship, in which case you could come in under the conservatorship provisions, which are already allow you to do temporaries. There are 281 of those filed last year. Just conservatorships of an adult, we show 61 filed. But like Mr. Sterling noted, as you all know, with our aging population, we would expect to see a significant increase in those over time, both because of the aging population and because it creates an opportunity that doesn't currently exist.
It may have been at this last bill hearing that I learned that we have the fastest growing senior population in the nation, in this state. Everyone's nodding their heads like it's true, and it's surprising to me, but it's something I guess I appreciate the department and the administration getting out in front of. Further questions on this point? Let's turn then. Mr. Sterling, let's finish working on your memo, because it does have some good suggestions. On page 2 of your memo, point number 2, you point out that on page 5, line 16, you would suggest replacing the current subsection F with some other language regarding a third party who's had actual or legal notice of a protective order and their duties with respect to that order. My question for you is you sort of duplicate the first line of that section. That's line 16 on page 5. Did you mean to delete the contents of lines 17 to 22, or just push them down accordingly to insert this language years?
Yeah. I did mean for that to be a replacement, and I apologize for the confusion in the drafting. And I would again, with the chair's permission, offer that I think we've corrected that problem in our work on the CS for the companion bill, and would offer, work on getting that language to the committee for consideration in this bill.
Excellent. Will do. Further questions on that point? Senator McGuire.
And through the chair, and not a question on that point. I want to make a different point.
Excellent.
So.
Please do.
Okay. So, and just as we go through the bill, just a reminder that it's not just seniors that we're talking about, as I think it's important that we have in our mind who the person is we're talking about. So my brother, for example, with a traumatic brain injury, we went through this in our family. So you might have somebody who, and he was 17 at the time, so that didn't seem like a big deal. But once he got into his 20s, for example, 24, 25, you start having issues of individual liberty that come into play. And we have the highest number per capita of traumatic brain injury survivors in Alaska, and more of them returning now because of the war in Iraq. It's basically the Agent Orange, if you will, of the Iraqi war. So we can expect not only the number of seniors to grow, but the number of those with traumatic brain injury to grow. So I think it's really important that this provision be added, because we're not just talking about people who are, you know, we're talking about people who are in the earning years, essentially, and may be incompetent on some levels, may not be able to manage their financial affairs on some levels, may certainly be victims of fraud, but it certainly should be their right to have notice, to be able to have that three-day period to go with counsel before and at least exercise that opportunity. And I know it's going to cause more time in the court and more money. I recognize it, but Alaska is very good about recognizing individual liberties, and I think we have to remember who the person might be in this position.
Excellent reminder, Senator McGuire. Thank you very much for that. Senator Passman.
Question on this point two on page two, that second paragraph where it talks about effective upon all persons upon that order being recorded with the state recorder.
You're reading from Scott Sterling's letter.
Yes.
Now. Yeah, thank you.
Yes. What is that intended to speak to?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, the discussion on the companion bill revealed that echoing the concern you just articulated, which is how do we ensure that adequate due process notice accompanies the ex parte order process? And the remedy that we came up with was to have actual service of the order delivered, mailed, or faxed to the nearest principal residence or business of the third party. For example, say the branch office of the bank where the elder or vulnerable adult's account is. That could, in a village or rural hub, that could be, you know, the banking branch that covers a very large area for all the people. The idea of recording it with the state recorder turned out not to be viable because of some provisions that are already in the law in Title 40 concerning DNR and the operation of the state recorder's office. The legislative drafters on the companion bill came up with substituting in language that say the order would be effective in terms of notice upon it being registered with the Department of Public Safety. That ties into the provision of the bill that creates a registry of financial protective orders within the Department of Public Safety, similar to the one that now exists for domestic violence and sexual stalking orders. So there would be a two-pronged actual notice requirement. One would be that notice be delivered, faxed, or mailed to the third party at their nearest residence or place of business, and then also notice would suffice if the order is registered with the Department of Public Safety. This is an effort to address the reality of the fact that most financial institutions operating in our state are national corporations or national companies, and they have branches and they have the ability to contact and research the recorder's office or a registry such as that, as would be contemplated to be created by in the Department of Public Safety. On the family abuse level, where most cases involve a family member exploiting a vulnerable member, the thought would be that if the protective order is served upon that alleged perpetrator at that person's residence or nearest place of business, that would satisfy due process requirements for receiving notice.
Just a Senator Pascan.
So the person that you're referencing here is the perpetrator. It's not the financial institution that if the perpetrator gets notice, writes a check that they have on grandma's account, runs to the bank, but it's been registered, but the bank doesn't know about it.
Well, the provision we're speaking to right now is the third-party provision, but the scenario you just articulated is one where the in the application for the ex parte relief, the court would have to be notified that, for example, the vulnerable adult has an account at the local branch of the local bank. The order would have to be served upon that branch so that they know that the perpetrator can't come in and try and access that account. It would also have to be served on the perpetrator so that they are held liable for obeying it. And that would be the mechanism by which both the third party and the alleged perpetrator would be unable to, let the fraud continue.
Right. I mean, you're going to have to, from time to time, enlist the aid of third parties to make particularly financial matters effective. And they've got to know, even though they're not the petitioner, they're not the respondent, but they're financial actors in one way or another, banks, other institutions, that it's time to stop honoring the checks, for example, written and signed by someone who's now been taken off the account by order of a court.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I don't wish to dominate the discussion or prolong it, but
no one else
in
is
reality,
raising their hand.
But let me give you, if I could give an example, this
sure.
is very typical.
Sure.
What happens is a family member holds a nominally valid power of attorney instrument.
Sure.
Under our power of attorney statutes, a third party such as a bank or a financial institution is obliged to honor that nominally valid power of attorney and could be held liable mm-hmm. to a certain amount of damages if they don't. Mm-hmm. And our power of attorney statute exists to ensure that the transactions are allowed to proceed and that people honor that agency designation. We don't want to put a third party in a difficult position of having to figure out, well, do I honor the power of attorney or don't I? And the idea of the protective order is to say, for the moment, for the period that this order is in effect, you will not honor that power of attorney. Pending subsequent court hearing, either the order will get dissolved or extended. And in the interim, it can be determined should that power of attorney be revoked, either by the petitioner, him or herself, or by action of the court. So the effort here would be to give third parties adequate notice that, particularly financial institutions, that be on the alert for the fact that there is now a problem with someone abusing a power of attorney, for example, and do not honor that under the protection of this order until the situation can be clarified.
Makes sense. Senator Pascan.
So in essence, because the effectiveness upon being recorded with a state recorder or under a registry is an imputed notice concept, and what you're saying is that the banks would have to check that registry or state recorder's office.
They would have to check the registry if they didn't otherwise receive a actual
right.
notice, delivery, fax, or mail. And, of course, with the real property conveyancing requirements of our statutes and recording, financial institutions are regularly check the recording system to ensure, and under the UCC, to ensure that they're on notice and that they're aware of what's been filed in UCC filings. So, yes, it would be a case where a third party who doesn't otherwise receive actual notice would need to check with the registry to see if that power of attorney is subject to a protective order.
Further questions on this topic? I don't hear or see any. Thank you. Mr. Sterling, let's turn last now to your suggested change of definition of fiduciary duty on page 18, line 22, from the language that we received in the bill when it was first submitted to your idea. And any, I don't have any particular adherence to either one. Maybe you can tell us why you're suggesting the change of the language.
Mr. Chairman, again, this is a very same question we addressed in the work on the companion bill, and I did cite to a case, Paskman v. Message.
Way to go, Mr. Sterling.
That's pretty good. That's pretty
I'm not sure if Senator Paskman was admitted back then, but...
It was a long time ago.
Anyway, in that case, the Supreme Court articulated a legal definition of a confidential or fiduciary relationship, and the language that I took for the bill came from that definition. And I did provide the citation and the quote.
And
I thought that
sure,
in as much as the doctrine of fiduciary relationship is a common law doctrine that gets amended from time to time by statutes, I thought that it would be most consistent with the existing law to use that definition.
Sure. Let me just ask why, or if we need to refer to a third party. The line says fiduciary duty means the duty of a third party who stands in a position of trust or confidence with another person. Do we have to say third party, or can we just say a person?
We can say a person, and Mr. Chairman, and again, that's a syntactical and language problem that we addressed in the companion bill work, and again, that's another one where we'll make sure that this committee receives that language that hopefully corrected it.
Sure. Okay, further further discussion of the fiduciary duty definition or other points made by Mr. Sterling? Don't see any. Great. Let's turn then to mandatory reporters and mandatory reporting. We are on page 8 of the bill, or actually most of the information is on page 9. It starts in section 16 of the bill, subsection E of 4724010, and you'll see, committee members will see on page 9, line 5, there's a shall, and there was some question about, you know, who has to report. Now, the issue is the first subsection A of that statute has mandatory reporting. There's a whole bunch of people who have to make mandatory reports within, I think, 24 hours to the division about a vulnerable adult. And then we say in subsection E, but if you really think it's an emergency, you have to tell a police officer. And then it tells the police officer how to make his or her report onto the division. And I asked last time whether there's a penalty for not making that report. And I'm turning now to the Department of Law or to Mr. Sterling to see if you've had any further thoughts on that topic.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Kelly Hendrickson. Again, I'm an Assistant Attorney General with Department of Law. I represent Department of Health and Social Services. I don't think that we contemplated, honestly, a penalty for that, because this is more meant to be an incentive. And if we ever did consider a penalty, I don't think we've ever pursued that. Ms. Page may be able to comment on that, but it certainly wasn't something that we contemplated.
It crossed my mind that if we were going to do that, we've already got a penalty section in subsection C. We could just lump those in with subsection C, but maybe Ms. Gibbons has some thoughts on that. Ms. Gibbons?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any additional thoughts on that. I am going to defer to Ms. Henriksen on that. I think that if it is already, my initial response would be if it is already covered in another section, then that should probably take care of it.
Mr. Chairman, I will say that I found a very similar provision in the OCS mandatory reporting language that is a little shorter than ours, but it has the same sentence: the peace officer shall immediately take action to protect the child and shall at the earliest opportunity notify the nearest office of the department. And that's on 4717.020.
And I think the peace officer's obligations here are clear. The peace officer, I think, just falls back under subsection A again. Peace officer is now, you know, a mandatory reporter, as he would have been under subsection A if he discovered it him or herself. Someone tells him, then he's told he has to report to the department, and subsection A covers that. I think the issue is whether we, and it may be just a picayune point we can let go, but the issue is, you know, we've got a shall here. We're saying, look, if you can't tell the department right away, then you got to tell a cop. What if you don't tell the cop? We do have a statute on the books that makes it a crime not to report a crime against a vulnerable adult. That's 1156-767. But those are serious, you know, violent crimes committed against an adult. Now we're down in sort of the area of abandonment and undue influence. But I guess I just want the committee to think about whether we want to have a shall without any penalty.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you that it relates back to subsection A, and I don't imagine that we would treat a police officer any differently than a mandatory reporter if you view the officer as a mandatory reporter in that incident.
Right, and I think the police officer is covered. It's the reporting person on line four who we're not covering. The police officer's duties, I think, are clear. The VPSO's duties are clear. It's the reporting person who we before said, well, you might want to tell a police officer. Now we're saying you shall tell a police officer. And I think those reporting persons are the same mandatory reporters as we already have in subsection A. And Senator Passing.
Yeah, on page 9, where it says, this is on page 9, line 11, 12, it says, if the decision is under the subsection to take immediate action, it may not bring an action unless it is with gross negligence or intentional misconduct. Is there a reason for only including to take immediate action as compared to the officer making the decision not to take immediate action?
Now, that's current statute, so I'll turn to the department.
Senator Pascman, through the chair, would you ask that in a different way? I'm afraid I don't understand exactly what you said.
Okay, I assume the sentence at 11, 12, you know, that 11 through 16, it says if the decision is to take immediate action, that they cannot be sued unless there's gross or intentional misconduct.
Yes.
And I guess why wouldn't it include also a decision not to take immediate action would also...
I see. Given some sort of level of immunity at the lower intent levels.
In other words, using the same gross negligence or intentional misconduct standard, does that sentence in the sense that it follows the police officer or VPSO, does that sentence apply to the sentence before? That's the way I'm reading it, but maybe I'm reading it incorrectly.
Senator Passman, through the chair, I believe I read it the way you do, too. So a decision is made to take immediate action, in my mind, includes whether you take it or whether you don't take it.
Right.
And it applies to the VPSO and the police officer.
And in the sentence above, they say if the decision to take or not take, but then the sentence right after it says only the decision to take immediate action
through the chair
has immunity unless you violate a gross negligence or intentional misconduct. It's just an odd wording.
through the chair, Senator Passman, it is inconsistent.
Yes.
I would guess that our interpretation is your interpretation. Agree with you. And it would not be difficult to make to add those couple of words to the second sentence so that the two are consistent.
Okay.
Very good. Further comments on the reporting and mandatory reporting? I think my concerns are satisfied, Senator Passman. We'll keep an eye out for the opportunity to insert a couple words there. Let's see, other areas of concern. That's my list. Anything else from the Department of Law? We do have one person signed to testify. We do have one person signed to testify. Marie Darlin is here. Probably just take a short break and let her come up and give us AARP's views of the bill. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Marie Darlin, representing AARP, and we just want to add our support to this bill because we know that as our population is aging, we are seeing more and more of these kinds of problems that are coming to the fore, and so therefore we feel we should be prepared to handle them better than maybe what they have been. And to also reaffirm Senator McGuire's comments, this is not just for seniors, but you have your younger disabled people and children that also need this kind of protection. So therefore, we really think this is something that's needed and want to help support it. So with that, that's about all we have to say.
Excellent. Questions or comments? I don't see any. While we're on the public testimony phase, let's ask if there's anyone else here in the room who wants to make comment on this bill, or anyone else online who wishes to do so. Hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. I think we've got a good framework for a CS with the work that's been done on the other side and the comments developed today. Any other areas of concern with respect to the bill for members of the committee? Don't hear or see any. We will see a CS before the bill leaves here. So let's go ahead and set the SB 86 aside, and thank you so much for the folks who are here to help us with it today. It's a complicated bill, and I appreciate all your hard work on it. Let's turn.
Thank you,
Thank you, Mr. Sterling. Thank you. Let's turn to Senator Davis's bill. She's had a bill resting in the committee for a few days now. She's here. We have not taken public testimony on SCR 2. We have Brenda Erickson here from NCSL, I think, online. I'm going to guess to answer questions. Ms. Erickson, are you there?
Hello. Yes, I'm available to answer any questions that you may have.
Excellent. Is there anyone in the room who wants to testify besides the bill's sponsor on SCR 2? Anyone online? Hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony on SCR 2. We'll welcome Senator Davis to the committee. We got a good presentation on the bill at the last hearing from your staff. Anything you want to tell us about the bill?
I'm sorry that I was not able to be here at the first hearing on the bill. What I have to say is that I feel very adamant that this is in-house information that you need, and you probably won't have any public testimony coming because it's something that's going to benefit the legislature. And I feel that because we have that just as a temporary position, that is the speaker pro tem or Senate pro tem, only at the time when you get ready to take in at the beginning of the session, they sit in the chair while you take the names of the person that's going to be put into the position of speaker or president. And from that point on, they have no other function. It's a temporary function. But yet throughout the states, there are many, many states that have speaker pro tems. Out of 34 speaker pro tems in the state house, 7 of those are women, the rest are men. And in the Senate, there are 42 speaker Senate pro tems. 11 of them are women. The rest are men. So this could benefit the leadership position, because what it does, it allows the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate to use that position in the position in the way that they want to give them responsibility. I'm not trying to dictate what he gives to them or she gives to them. It's strictly up to the leader to decide that. I think this would be very, very beneficial to us, and I'm glad that you're bringing this back once more for your consideration.
Thank you, Senator Davis. Questions
and
for the bills?
And we do have somebody from NCSL if you have any questions that you need to ask.
Questions we can direct to them, yes. Very good. Questions for the bill sponsor, for the bill sponsor staff, or for Ms. Erickson? Don't see any. We've had the bill here for an opening hearing. This is the second hearing on the bill. Bill goes on to the Finance Committee. I don't have any proposed changes, amendments to the bill proposed by members of the committee. And seeing none, I would solicit a motion. Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move SCR 2 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just object just for a comment.
Please, Senator Senator Coghill.
Having been majority leader and the rules chairman, and looking at how the pro tem has actually worked, I personally don't see a need for this. I can understand why an extra leadership position could be useful, but at this point, I don't see the need for this change. So I'm not going to stop it. I won't vote against it in committee. I just wanted to make the objection to see that I don't really see the need for the change at this point. I don't see the value of having an extra leadership position in the legislature, but I know that's an internal discussion, so I'll just register my opinion at this point.
Very good.
I'll remove any objection.
So noted. And just so we're all clear for the record, the motion, I take it, Senator Wilikowski, was for the State Affairs version / B. Baker?
Yes.
And there being no objection to the motion, the bill moves. Thank you so much, Senator Davis. Let's take a short at ease while we sign the paperwork. Back on the record. We're back on the record with the last matter before us today is Senate Bill 30. And we have a CS before us, CS for Senate Bill number 30, /D. If I could be a motion to adopt that as a working document.
So moved.
Senator Wilikowski has moved that we adopt Senate /D is our working document. I'll object for the purposes of discussion and turn to Mr. Kopp from the bill sponsor's office to explain the changes. Welcome, Mr. Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to the community, the committee substitute for Senate Bill 30. I have provided a memo, which I believe you all have a copy of, that highlights the changes from the committee substitute that came out of State Affairs. This committee gave some good comments last time regarding the possibility that the bill language may allow an opportunity for a defendant to misuse the return of property hearing process and detract from the intention of the bill, which is it's a victim's rights bill, and that it would be good to use the current definition of crime victim to not introduce further complexities into determinations that the Office of Victims' Rights is not staffed to resolve, and stay consistent with their mission, which is victim advocacy. We fully support that, and this committee substitute was drafted in response to these concerns. Just briefly, the title of the act, there in line two, the owner language was deleted and inserted a crime victim. These changes are consistent throughout this bill to clarify that we are referring to crime victims as a class of property owners that we want to address in this. In line six, the language, the owner, is deleted and inserted a crime victim who is the owner. Again, in line nine, line 10 and line 11, the amendment is the language owner is deleted and the language crime victim is inserted. Going to page 2, on line 2 and line 7 and line 8, we have an identical amendment there where the word owner is deleted and the term crime victim is inserted. And then on line 13, we have deleted the words an owner and inserted the words a crime victim, again to clarify the legal status of property owners that we are trying to protect. The most significant, under recommendation from the Department of Law, expanded the original subsection D we had on line 14. We deleted all the remaining language from the State Affairs Committee substitute, which was lines 14 through 24, and inserted what you have before you today. What we put is that the language inserted is, if the court orders the return of the property to the crime victim, the court shall impose conditions to ensure that the property is available for future court proceedings. If the court cannot assure the availability of the property, the court shall establish the chain of custody up to the date of the property return and the admissibility of the property at future court proceedings. Under line 19, we have clarified that crime victim has the meaning given to victim in AS 1255-185, which is a current definition of victim without amendments. And then finally, line 25, we have deleted the term an owner and inserted crime victim. And again on line 25, we have deleted the term owner and inserted crime victim. So with those changes, I bring back to you this committee substitute. And I just heard on good word from Miss Annie Carpinetti that she is fully supportive of this as it is at this time.
Excellent. Thank you. Excellent explanation. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. We had a little bit of discussion about this in State Affairs, and there was testimony in State Affairs about an owner of property who was actually not a crime victim. In fact, they were the only people that testified, and I think the reason that this bill was initially brought forward, they were not actually crime victims. They were, I believe they were either a pawn shop or a reseller. Mm-hmm. They were holding property, and the police came in and took the property from them. And so they would no longer be covered under this change?
I do see it a little differently. There are collateral victims of crimes, and certainly they may not have been an initial victim, but the fact that they are, that a crime did occur and that they are a collateral victim, maybe not the first intended target, but they are suffering a financial or pecuniary loss and don't have a recourse, we could say that at some point it did come down to where they were a victim of an original crime. So under that, I would say that Office of Victims' Rights would at least be able to make a determination that they are a crime victim under current definitions without changing that.
And I suspect Senator Pastor is looking up the definition of victim as we speak. 1255-185.
Senator Passman.
Okay. It's under subparagraph 19, means a person against whom an offense has been perpetrated, B, one of the following not the perpetrator if the person specified in A is a minor. That doesn't seem to apply.
So yeah,
that's awkward at best.
It would be.
If you read that, I mean, it's, I think it's awkward at best.
Yeah, it would be an interpretation to say that an offense has been perpetrated against this owner, that they are now without their property.
Well, let's slow down. Let's go back to Senator. I mean, the basic definition I think is one most people can understand. It's a person against whom an offense has been perpetrated, whether it's an assault, a robbery, rape, fraud, embezzlement, whatever. That the basic definition works. I think we're back to Senator Wilkowski's question and maybe just a policy call. I think Senator Wilkowski's hypothetical is theft of property. The thief sells it for $50 to a guy on the street. The guy on the street takes it to a pawn shop. And then what? The pawn shop buys it for $50 or pawns it for $50, and the police then come in and seize that property because it's evidence of a crime. Much as I love pawn shop owners, you know, my heartstrings are not strumming too hard here, but maybe there's something we can do. Ideas?
Senator? Well, the way I understand it right now is that if stolen property is in a pawn shop, they automatically take it now, no questions asked, because it's never been the pawn shops, and it's kind of their risk if they purchase stolen property. So I think what the pawn shop owner that called from Anchorage, the understanding that I have is that it was actually his property. The police came in. It's been 4 years later. They've never brought any charges against anyone, and he's out. You know, they're holding on to $5,000-$7,000 of jewelry that he says it's mine, and I can prove it. I just have no process of getting it back. So he's saying he's the owner. The police are saying they're investigating a crime, and so the original bill that Senator Dyson said is that here's the person that's the owner. He wants his property back. It's been 4 years.
Right.
Well, I'll turn to Mr. Kopp. What's the sponsor's view of the lay of the land as we are right now?
I like the fact that the language clarifies that this is a victim's rights bill. That is what it's about. I do believe that there are collateral victims to crimes. They may not be. You may not have been the initial that I perpetrated against, but there are other victims that are collateral victims as a result of an action that a perpetrator may take. And, you know, with respect to pawn shops, you do need to show that property was taken with reckless disregard, that it was stolen, before culpability would attach. If they can show that everything they did followed process and there was nothing about how they identified the person who pawned, received, took it in according to the laws as we have now, it isn't automatic that we see that it certainly may be prohibited from being sold pending investigation. But it's hard to have a perfect bill when we are advocating for victims that will account for every possible scenario. And I recognize that. Senator Dyson recognizes it. It's pretty difficult. But I think we get most people in the terms that we're using now that we want to help by intent of the bill.
Senator Wilkowski.
And I just thought of a way that this change could actually be better than the other, the state affairs version. That is, let's say I am the owner of a car, and I rent it to Senator French for a period of a year. First day he has it, the car is stolen. Police take possession of it. I, as the owner, I guess under the old bill, would have had the right to go in and claim it. But let's say I decide not to. Under this bill, the change, he's the crime victim, I'm guessing, and so now he has the ability to go in and change. So it's a policy call, I think, Mr. Chairman.
Right. It's a fascinating area, mm-hmm. and you know it's Senator Dyson's bill. You know, it's certainly not a concern that ever been brought to me by the community. The community hasn't come to me and said, "Hey, we got a problem with evidence sitting in lockers that belongs to us or me or my family." Senator Dyson's hypothetical I heard over and over was theft from a construction site, and the construction materials, heavy equipment, whatever else, and generators, is so hard to reclaim from the police that the construction owners were more or less giving up. They would certainly be that. So this bill at least strikes that example of the problem he was trying to solve.
Yes, Chairman. Yeah, that they're crime victims and
right.
directly.
No doubt about it.
Directly. They're, right. I think in respect to determining who crime victims are, it is good that there's a little bit of room for interpretation, because sometimes, as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, in the last hearing, it can be a little messy at times determining exactly when someone falls into that crime victim status, because crimes can be messy, and there's varying degrees of culpability. And so I think the fact that it's not clearly defined in every circumstance, what we want the law to allow for people to appeal for property that maybe they're not the classic crime victim.
Sure. Senator Passman.
Do we, right now under the CS on page 2, lines 19 and 20, it explicitly defines crime victim as being victim under the definition. Would it work if we said crime victim includes but is not limited to the meaning given to victim in there, to where where we're saying it's the definition of
at least this person, but it may be
yeah,
other people,
but it potentially may yeah. be it includes but it's not limited to that, so we allow for the potential that there may be unique situations okay. like this pawn shop, and that's just
food for thought. Senator Wilkowski has a thought.
Yeah. Just maybe an I don't know if this is an inconsistency or not, but page 2, lines 6 through 9, we say, after hearing, the court may order the return of the property in the custody of law enforcement agency to the crime victim if the crime victim, by a preponderance of the evidence, provides satisfactory proof of ownership. So I guess in the case of I'm renting the car, you're renting the car for me, you are not the owner, but you are the crime victim.
Mm-hmm.
So that may be something that needs to be tweaked.
Mm-hmm. But if
I don't
lease,
follow that.
Well, I think Senator, well, you know, and this would, you know, we would hope that this would be read, and maybe we just need to make it more clear. The concern is that I think the car rental is a working and useful hypothetical. If the car's stolen from me, am I the crime victim?
I think you're the victim, but
when a rental car is stolen, who's the victim? Is it Hertz, or is it me, the guy that was driving the car?
Certainly, well, both of you
the
are.
The car goes back to Hertz, right?
Right. I mean,
right.
Both of you would be a victim initially, but the
right.
ultimate financial loss would be back to
borne by Hertz.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
If you steal a rental car, so
it's their property.
Can Hertz? I mean, we probably need yeah. to ponder this. You know, can Hertz? Because certainly, I'm done caring. I mean, you steal my rental car. I mean, if it's
right.
Bills, if it's my buddy's bills, that's one thing.
Sure.
But if it's you know, and I'll go to war for him. Right. But you know, if it's Hertz's, I go home and I'm done.
Well,
I'm done worrying.
I think under crime victim, it's clear that Hertz is the victim. I mean, they are the owner of the car.
Right.
And what we're doing is we're kind of right. talking about, well, maybe do we want to go back to the word
right.
owner?
And I think maybe even back to the Senator Wilkowski's hypothetical, I'm not the victim so much as he's the victim. His car has been stolen. I mean, when the thief doesn't sort of, when the thief goes and grabs a car, he isn't worried about who the yeah. real owner is.
That,
right?
That's true. But
right.
the word crime victim would apply both to you and to you.
Right.
The property
I'm not even sure I am.
Person renting the car. Well, you're certainly without, at least in the short run.
Without the car,
somebody
would,
deprived
right.
you of the
right.
use of your vehicle,
right.
and then certainly the property. I think crime victim covers both in that scenario.
Yeah. Senator Passman.
Getting back to the pawn shop owner, the definition of victim says against whom an offense has been perpetrated. What offense would the pawn shop owner in this particular case say has been perpetrated?
Fraud, in some sense, right?
Well, but But against whom? I mean, he says it's my property. The police got it. I don't know why they have it. They got it.
Right. He would be a victim of theft, either theft by as dishonest portrayal of maybe either if someone was to bring property
just
to them under
a point of order, because I think Senator Passavant is posing one hypothetical and maybe answering a different one.
Okay.
Hypothetical that Senator Passavant is, I think, posing is not that someone has come in and seized pawned property. The police have seized property belonging to the pawn shop owner and believes that it's property that was stolen and being harbored there.
As I understand the testimony, the pawn shop owner doesn't know why the property was taken. Nothing has ever been told to him, so
right.
Then the pawn shop owner says they think that there might have been an offense. I have no idea what that may have been.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that there's no offense because no charge has ever been brought. Mm-hmm. All I want to do is get my property back.
Yep.
And the intent of this bill was to give a avenue or a remedy to the pawn shop owner to get his property back, and by the definition of victim that's expressly included in here, you have to define an offense, and it has to be a crime perpetrated, you know, a person against whom offense has been perpetrated. And
sure.
So it's odd legal language.
It is odd. I would say in the simplest terms that the original offense was theft and that they were a collateral damage of that theft. Unfortunately, in that circumstance, Senator Passavant, the police department never communicated to the pawn shop the specifics, so they were at a loss as to nature of investigation, status. We can only speculate as to what might have happened to that property or where it might be or what the status is, but all we know is that there wasn't a voice
right.
for them, and they were a victim somehow of that.
I'll just say, I guess before I went too far down that solving this particular individual's problem, I would want to hear from the police and know what it is that they believe about the case. And I'm just, you know, I think it's just worth putting out there that
yeah.
the police must have, well, I don't
yeah.
know, but I just got to believe that there's something on the other side of that score.
And Mr. Chair, by way of, I think we should also discuss a other language that was brought for defining crime victim. One option we had was includes any person who is the owner of property that, one, is in the custody of a law enforcement agency in connection with the criminal case, and two, is not evidence of a crime of which the person has been charged, indicted, or presented. That was one of the options. And ultimately, we came back to staying with the definition in the law. Some of it was using Office of Victims' Rights as an intermediary. It is a definition that they work with every day. It keeps them consistent with their mission statement without having to add extra expertise to the office. And we would have to recognize that there are collateral victims of crime, so if we do it that way.
It's, I just, you know, for the record, had a sort of a lingering concern that we were somehow empowering defendants with the earlier version of the bill. That was
right.
basically my concern, and it was to a large degree how we got where we are right now.
And did this version clear that up for you, Mr. Chair?
Right. Okay. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean,
and so
there's still some folks in the gray area that we may not be helping, but in my heart, you know, I know that we're not sending the OVR folks out to go to war for
right. Yeah.
people that are bad guys.
And it is hard in a victim's rights bill like this to get the language perfect to cover every scenario,
it's
but I think we cover crime victims, who we want to give a voice to. And we may not be able to account for every scenario and hypothetical we put out there, but I think if someone can be determined to be in a victim class of a crime, whether a primary or secondary, at least OVR can make an initial determination of whether they can have a hearing.
Why don't we do this? Senator Passavant has given this bill some serious thought. I know Senator Wilikowski has. Why don't we hold the bill over till Monday, let folks look at the CS, and then unless we have something concrete to go on, we'll move Senator Dyson's bill on.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Please appreciate
appreciate the good committee discussion today. Anything else to come forward to committee? We're done 10 minutes early.
Okay.